And I remained that way throughout the time we were in reserve. And then we moved in April. We moved into back into the Jamestown position line, which is the front line, and to the Natron feature. And we were on the Natron feature. The RCR were on the left of us on another feature, and on the right was a British battalion. I forgot the name at the time, not right now. And we got in there and settled down and did our regular patrolling. Then on the night of May the 2nd, 3rd, during the day of the May the 2nd, we started getting shelling. And Bob Bruce was my battle adjutant at the time, and Eric Eisner was acting as 2IC. I was the battalion commander. And Bob had been with the 1st Battalion for several months before we arrived, and hadn't completed the tour, so he was remaining with us. He said, "Look, if to him it felt as if we were going to be attacked, or somebody was going to be attacked, because the shelling was inconsistent with what they usually do, but consistent to what they did when they had an attack." So we were kind of prepared for this, and then things quietened out, and we had a shift arrangement that I took over throughout the daytime and up to midnight. I took over at the command post, and then from midnight until 8 in the morning, Bob Bruce took over. Well, things around 10 o'clock started to get a little warmed up. We got a lot of shelling, and then we found out that the Chinese were attacking our positions, and also the RCR. And the RCR were getting the worst of it. We had a fighting patrol out in front, which had gone out early on in the evening, and we thought for sure we were going to lose them, and we tried to contact them, but we'd lost contact with them. But they had been in contact with the Chinese, and they gradually moved back, and we lost one prisoner. One man was taken prisoner, and we had one man killed that time. But the rest of them did very good indeed. We had one officer get the MC, and one sergeant get the MM for their work during that time. During the attack, which continued all night, we had one heavy machine gun position in the front lines on the Natron feature, which was dug in and had a slit across like that where they could fire and cover the whole German position out in front of us. The positions were on hills, and then there was a valley between us and the Chinese. And at nighttime, the Chinese just centered on this machine gun position and kept the fire going, so that the bullets came through the slit in there and pinned against the wall at the back. And I was there early at first light the next morning. I got down to this position, and you could just see a hole about 3 feet across where those bullets had come in continuously. The men couldn't use the machine gun. They just had to lie down there. And yet, that was 1,000 yards at least across there that they had. But they pinpointed that machine gun at some time. Yeah. And they just laid onto it, and they were most accurate fire. They just kept everything down. And it was never mentioned in the, for some reason or other, no one paid too much attention to it. But I'll never forget when my patrol, at least my visit early the next morning, to see what the positions were like, to see this tremendous amount of lead in the trench at the back. And the lads were telling me that they just had to give up. They couldn't stay in the position. They were lying down, and they just crawled out and got away from it. But it meant that no one could get up and down from that position unless they crawled along the trench. Well, the morning of the 3rd came along, and we found the RCR had been pretty badly hammered. They'd lost a lot of men, and they'd lost a position. But the Chinese had evacuated at the end, and so they retook it over with reinforcements from the from their company in reserve. We stayed on the Natron feature until June, when we were relieved by the Bandus. I think there's one interesting aspect. When I took over the position on the Natron, I was taken over from a Thailand battalion, who they couldn't speak a word of English, and I couldn't speak a word of Thai. But we managed to get along all right. Their position wasn't left very clean. haven't got the same sense of cleanliness as we have. So we had quite a problem cleaning it up. But when I was getting them out, got them off the out of the front position and back into a rear place, I saw a great bonfire being lit. And because this was could be seen by the Germans, at least the flare, at least by the Chinese, the flare of it could be. So I told them to put it out, and showed them what I meant, and they did that. And then I turned my back and I was walking away when I heard the click of a rifle being loaded. And I thought, well, I've had it, but I wouldn't. I had my driver with me only, and I thought, well, I just won't pay, I'll just ignore it. I just continued on and walked around the rest of the positions. And I thought, they didn't like me putting the fire. It was a cold night when we took over, and I guess they wanted to keep warm, but we found it was, we didn't want the Chinese to know that we had changed, but people, you know, there'd been a change in positions at all. So that was the only really interesting thing. In June, we returned into, we went into reserve, and the Van Duse took over from us, and at the same time, Colonel McLaughlin took over command of the battalion from me. We then went, we were in reserve for another month or so, and during that time we were dive bombed by airplanes, which turned out to be Americans. They were returning from a sortie up north, and they thought they were still in the north, and they saw this position and the bridge down, which we were just below us, and they bombed the bridge and killed a number of South Koreans who were guarding it, and they destroyed some of their own equipment, which they had a big equipment camp close by, and they machine gunned us, who we were in a valley, but fortunately none of us got, we all had slit trenches, so we were in those and none of us got hurt from it. But it was quite amusing at the time. It was a little bit of tension while it was happening. This would be at first light, you know, and because the poor Americans were very unhappy about it, then their general was extremely unhappy, and he sent all the officers back who were in it, find their planes back to the United States in disgrace. But General West, who was commanding the division at the time, tried to stop me. He said, you know, it was a mistake that could happen. They had been flying at night and coming back, and they thought they were still in North Korea. But his words didn't help at all. They were returned. And from then on, we had a fairly quiet time, and we went on to the Hill 355, which is the big high point, and they were shelled and occasionally there. It commanded the whole of the front, and in front of it were the Chinese positions, which were Colonel Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the from the Bible thing, and they were trying. They've always tried to get 355. The Chinese had ever since they've been there. The RCR had been badly attacked on it, and the Thailanders and things like that. But they never successfully got it. And then while we were on 355, peace was declared, and I went up that day, and there were the Chinese on their positions with great flags flying and waving to us and calling across to us to come along and see them and visit us, and of course we stopped at all. We wouldn't allow any of the men to go up because we didn't know what was going to happen. And then from then on, it was meant that all our defensive positions had to be pulled down, because we had some pretty good ones there and great timbers, and they were dismantled and the timber taken back to the reserve area. We didn't get it all back before the time was up, so the Chinese got a lot of good bits of timber to build their defensive positions with. And from then on, we did exercises in movement to the front in case the Chinese decided to attack. We had defensive positions back further on from them. We patrolled the stay back line, or the neutral line that they had. We had to have a company up there patrolling all the time, and we had lookout towers built so we could keep over keep an eye on the neutral zone. But nothing really startling happened. We'd get infiltration occasionally, but you never knew. You couldn't tell Thailander from a North Korean, South Korean, or Chinaman. They all looked the same to us, but they could tell because the Koreans themselves knew. And I then in November, I flew back to Canada because I was going to Staff College. And the battalion came back by ship. I met them in Vancouver when they arrived back. And they marched through the streets of Vancouver and caught the train to Calgary, where they were disbanded. And then the 3rd Battalion became the 3rd Battalion Canadian Guards. I went to Staff College in 54, January 54 at Kingston. Completed Staff College. I won't say it was easy. I found it very strenuous because I was tired from a year in Korea. I hadn't had too much. You never got very much sleep at all. Even, you know, even when you were back, there was always something going on. There was exercise. So you had to be on the alert all the time. Mm-hmm. You always had a company, or some a battalion on standby and a company on standby and things like that. So I was fairly, I think I was fairly tired when I got back, but I did my tour in Staff College and was posted to Brigade Headquarters at Valcarce. Mm-hmm. Spent a year with them, and which was most interesting. We had, as in French Canada, I saw a lot of Quebec. We had exercises over the various parts of mm-hmm. Of Quebec. We'd both for the officers of the brigade and the for troops. I think one interesting event was that Brigadier Allard, who was commanding the brigade at the time, wanted to hold a toot tactical exercise without troops for the officers and across the river, quite away from Quebec. It was a 2 or 3 hour drive from Valcarce, and he sent one of the LOs from the gate to go and talk to the mayor of the village where we went and say he would like to use this land and for this toot. And the LO came back and said, oh, he couldn't get anywhere. They want rent for the thing and all this. So the brigadier said to him, well, he said, did you see the local priest? And the fellow said, no, he said, I didn't see. He said, oh, you don't see the mayor, you're going to see the local priest, he runs the place. So the next day he sent him down again with the RC Padre this time, and they went down to see the local priest, and sure enough they got exactly what they wanted without any problems. The farmers didn't ask for compensation. And it was a very good tactical exercise, a lot of troops held there, and it was a defensive position under atomic warfare or nuclear warfare. Because this was the thing that would come up now, and so the brigade was involved in that. I stayed a year with the brigade, then I was posted to Churchill as the G2, and this time I took my family with me, and I spent 2 years up there. This is because we had the IGY year in progress, so we were very busy all the time, the International Geophysical Year. Rockets were being launched. Well, the base was being built for the rockets, and then the rockets were launched from there into the sky. The American engineers did all this work. A fantastic amount of equipment they brought up on the train, and it was really amazing what they could do with their equipment. We feel such a poor cousin when you see that.
Yeah. What exactly is G2?
General Staff Officer, or Grade 2, which is now, I think. I forget what they call it. It's a General Staff Officer Grade 2. Mm-hmm. It's a G1, G2, and G3. I suppose you'd call it Staff Officer Operations now or something like that. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for the operations and security of the camp. We had to plan, while I was there, we were planning for the defense of the camp, the evacuation of the camp in case of a war and things like that. Mm-hmm. And all visitors coming up to the camp were a responsibility of mine. I had to... the security clearance would be done by mm-hmm. Ottawa. And that. But we had all the visitors. We had the NATO ambassadors came up to visit us. The staff colleges came up. It was a busy place. As I said, it was the only army establishment which a cocktail party lasted for 2 years. And because there was one, you know, we always said that anytime a visitor came into Ottawa, and it was on a Friday, they immediately sent him up to Churchill so they wouldn't be bothered with him over the weekend. And we had to look after him over the weekend. But it was a most interesting posting. I enjoyed it. My family enjoyed it. And then in 1956, I was posted to Australia. And I left Churchill in May, I think it was, of 56, and came down and spent a month's holiday here in Victoria, caught the ship from Vancouver and took a ship down to Melbourne, and had a most enjoyable 2 years attached to the Australian Army at Army Headquarters, which was in Melbourne at that time. I was able to travel to most parts of Australia, either as on official business or else on leave.
Mm-hmm.
I went across to Perth with the King's Medal, or the Queen's Medal for the rifle shoot, and was able to see that part of the country. I flew over there and came back by train, and so I saw a good part of that. And then on my, I was up to Canberra and to the Staff College at Queenscliff, gave a lecture on Arctic warfare there, and had meetings with the External Affairs Department, their Antarctic Division, and showed them all the Arctic clothing that we use, and they were most interested with it. In fact, they bought the string vests and shoes from it, and quite a bit of our equipment, because I received a letter just before I left Australia from the Trade Commissioner, thanking me for the business that I'd put towards the to Canada for this equipment. They'd been buying Norwegian equipment prior to that, mm-hmm. and they found ours was better than the Norwegian.
Had you trained quite a bit with the Norwegians at the time in the Arctic training? Because I think only Canada and Norway are really the only ones that are prepared for winter warfare at all, in NATO that I know.
No, we didn't do any training at all. We had nothing to do with the Norwegians in those days, no. We had Americans come up to Churchill, because they had American base at Churchill as well, American a small American group there, but we used to train some Americans in Arctic warfare, but not too much. They sent, prior to my time or after my time, they sent a battalion of Americans up from Virginia up there in one flight,
mm-hmm.
to see how they would react to the cold, but they didn't do the same amount of training as we did,
mm-hmm.
and because now the Canadians and Norwegians work quite closely together. But they didn't when I was there. There was nothing like that. The Australians were very interested in it because they have quite a big Antarctic division, but they don't have any military down there. It's all civilians.
Mm-hmm.
But they were certainly interested in what we were doing. Because just the same as we're interested in their jungle warfare, and things, which is another thing I managed to spend several days at jungle warfare school,
mm-hmm.
and learn about that. And then their combined operations and their school of infantry. And that.
Supposed to be quite expert at
yes,
that.
Yes,
of thing.
They are.
Right.
They're very good. And then 2 years in Australia went very quickly, and I was hoping to get to Papua New Guinea, because that came under the Australians at the time, and I was set for a flight there with the director of military training, and it was bumped in the end because the plane, they had to take some black jelly beans or something up to the one of the Air Force outposts up there, and so I was bumped for that, and I was quite unhappy about, because I'd looked forward to it. I'd received all my inoculations and that, and the director was very unhappy, but the only way I could have gone up was to go by civilian aircraft, and that was too expensive, because the Australian Army would have had to pay for it. Let's see, what else was it in Australia? I managed to make trips up into Queensland, up through there. Oh, and I did go on there. They had a tremendous exercise across in through Queensland up through the north, which went for a month. They had their Australian Army moving through the savannah as well as the jungle, and I went up as an observer on that and found it most interesting. We started from Mackay on the Queensland coast and moved inland. And the country up there it really is wonderful to go through, and altogether different to our type of country as well,
mm-hmm.
Because you'd be going through this jungle, and you come to a great field of grassland and that, and a few gum trees and that. I returned to Canada in 1960, October 1960. I was posted to the School of Infantry. And to the tactics wing, and became an instructor in tactics there where we were specializing in nuclear warfare. Oh, I might say that while I was in Australia, the I was given the task by the Australians of editing and preparing their pamphlet on nuclear warfare, and because I had taken several courses of it in Canada, and I'd been to the ABCW course and things like that, and so they asked me to prepare this pamphlet for them, which I did. I have a copy, but now it's kind of out of date, but it was the first time I suggested they make it into a loose leaf form, because most of their pamphlets were bound, mm-hmm. and with nuclear warfare, well, with the nuclear warfare changing so rapidly, it would be much easier to remove a page than to cut out a bunch of stuff and paste it on top of a page. So mm-hmm. I suggested that, and they did that, and they've continued with their training pamphlets since then. Mm-hmm. Or at least the other ones that were made when I was here were all loose leaf for the first time. I also wrote up the pay regulations for the Pacific Islands Regiment in their Motu and Pidgin language, and how much they get paid for it. And I used to go up to Queensland to the headquarters of Brisbane and discuss that with them, and meet some of the Pacific Island Regiments, which are the Papuans and New Guinea, who are a wonderful bunch of men. Tall, black head, fussy haired, but they really make wonderful soldiers. Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to Camp Borden, I was there and I spent about a year and a half in the School of Infantry when it came for my time to retire. Whilst at School of Infantry, I was made administrative officer for Exercise Toxin 1, which was the big nuclear exercise involving the whole of Canada. It was an attack by nuclear bombs on Canada, and the government would, cabinet ministers and that would move into Camp Borden, and we converted one of the men's living quarters into a bomb-proof, fallout shelter kind of place, supposedly, and they'd work from there for 2 or 3 days, and just as the same as they would if a nuclear war had started. It was quite interesting. We had all in addition to the federal government, we had a lot of provincial government people come up, and it was quite a success. We learned a lot there. And then the following year, just before I left, another exercise came up, Exercise Toxin 2, which I managed to get out because I felt that one of the other officers who was staying in the Army should take it on, because I was leaving within 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So. Although I did work on it, but I didn't do the administration side of it. And I left Camp Borden in December 61 to return to, or at least to come to Victoria, where I retired. Trip to Victoria, I drove with my family, and I started off from Camp Borden, went to Montreal, spent a short time with friends, and then drove down and stayed in a U.S. Military and Air Force camps all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some wonderful quarters for married people who were on the traveling and that, something that the Canadian Army could do with.
Yeah.
But I just wrote ahead of time and told them I was a Canadian Army officer traveling to the West Coast. I had my family with me, and they wrote back every case. I got a very nice letter from them saying, we have arranged accommodation for you. And I arrived there late at night in some cases, but they were always ready for you, and then you could use their club for your meals. And I got down into Texas, I think it was, on New Year's Eve. I ran Fort Benning on Christmas Eve,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't get there until late, so there was a Canadian officer at Fort Benning whom I knew very well, but I thought Christmas Eve wasn't a good time to disturb him. So I waited till Christmas morning and phoned them, but we had a wonderful time there. They had a wonderful Christmas dinner in the officers' club, which everybody attended. And then I left on December the 26th, I left for a trip down and got to a big SAC air base in Texas. And prior to that, when I wrote down to say I would be there for New Year's Eve, they wrote back and asked me to join them, join the commandant and his party at their big New Year's Eve dance, and mm-hmm. thing. But we had three children with us, and I pointed this out, and they said, oh, well, they'd arrange babysitters for us, and things like that.
That right.
And so I had to, we turned it down because I didn't have the clothes with me, for one thing. We were just traveling light. We shipped everything off. And the other thing was that we were, after driving for that length of time and then going off there the next morning, I didn't feel that I should do it, because we set ourselves a very tight travel schedule, which we shouldn't have done. We should have allowed ourselves more time. But mm-hmm. when you're inexperienced at that in traveling, you thought, well, we should get home as soon as we could. And but they there again, that was a wonderful welcome to us. We had a complete house with a refrigerator full of food. Sorry, no, refrigerator had soft drinks and Canadian Club whiskey and that in for us. And all they said was little shit that if you use it, pay for it. I do. And we were invited. We went to a cocktail party at the Commandant's house before the ball started. When I apologized to him that we thought we should be on our way, because we were leaving at 6 o'clock the next morning to go to the next place. I'd worked it out; it would take us so long to get to these various places. But I thought, gosh, the Canadians, you know, we could do something like that. There's not a camp anywhere, I think, in which a soldier's mother or father or just come to visit, they can stay and to see them, whereby there they can. And in fact, we met at all these places, we met many mothers and fathers of people who were visiting their sons for Christmas, particularly on the officer side, because most of the men seem to get away for Christmas, mm-hmm. and the officers have to stay there. Mm-hmm. And they were all living in these quarters. And they were, as I said, they were extremely good. And we then arrived up to Victoria, where I proceeded to try and find a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that about...
Good. Okay. Yeah.